गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू एंड ग्रीटिंग्स वन मोर टाइम, वन लास्ट टाइम फ्रॉम बुएनोस आयर्स, एट लीस्ट फॉर दिस टाइम बीइंग। Since in a few days we are continuing our travels to Colombia, US, Europe, where I look forward to crossing paths with some of you at least, hopefully all or most. And happy and blessed to be again with all of you in Satsang, in holy association, holy vessel, trying to not figure out reality, right? Because you ultimately the crux of reality is not figurable, but trying to stay together with proper awe and appreciation and loving attitude to honor what reality is about in all of its expressions. So, as usual, you are invited to bring anything you may like to share today in the form of a question, in a quest, as we like to put it, more than a question. This is not so much questions and answers. This is not so much explanation, but exploration. This is not so much conversion, but conversation. So we are set on a quest, and you are invited to bring anything you may like to offer to the fire of today's circle. So you can do so by raising your digital hand, or sending a private message, public message in the text if you don't know how to raise your digital hand, and we will try to honor each one of you properly. So we will begin with Pradhana Gupika from Germany. Welcome to and invited to unmute yourself.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Actually, I have a question. I heard you already a few times saying, and please correct me if I've got it wrong, that we have to become a fully integrated person in order to become Krishna conscious. Of course, I have a, let's say, rough idea what it means to be a fully integrated person, but I would like to ask you to elaborate on it, if possible.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the question, which is a pivotal one, but also thank you for asking me to corroborate if I actually say that literally, which I don't think I did. I don't think I said literally like we have to become a fully integrated person before becoming Krishna consciousness. Krishna conscious, sorry. That said, I'm not denying that I say something to that effect, but not in that way. Because if not somehow, someone may think, okay, that human balance, psycho-emotional harmony is a necessary prerequisite for bhakti. So bhakti is not independent, and bhakti depends on whatever, a sattvic disposition or anything, which is not the teaching, right? The teaching is that bhakti is Jadrichaya, as the Srimad-Bhagavatam say, which is independent, moves according to her sweet will. So it can arrive at any vessel. It's not waiting for us to be absolutely, I don't know, pure, pious, sattvic, whatever idea we may have of what it means to be a good boy and a good girl. No? Because sometimes we got it backwards, so to say. We think, oh, I think some days ago I posted something by Father Richard Rohr in that regard. He will say, sometimes we think we will only be able to see God if we first become pure and pious. And he actually said that the other way is actually true. When we have a genuine contact with divinity, then our journey of purification and piety and whatever starts, so to say. So it's not that we need to wait. Because there are many of those ideas I've heard about the thinking. First, you have to become, I don't know, very renounced as a prerequisite to bhakti. Well, actually, Bhagavatam says the other way around. Janayate subairagyam jnanam cha yad haitukam vasudeva bhagavati bhakti yoga prayojita. From bhakti comes vairagya, detachment. It's not that detachment creates vairagya. Detachment creates bhakti, sorry. Bhakti comes from bhakti. Bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. That's the teaching of the Bhagavatam. Bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. Bhakti comes from bhakti, and bhakti takes to bhakti. It's all about bhakti. So I want to make that clear. So what I'm sharing is not misunderstood. Like I'm saying, first you have to be an absolutely perfectly integrated, healed, balanced, harmonized human being in every point. And the point is, who can be that, right? How do we know we are fully, absolutely integrated? What's the yardstick for that? And only then you can become Krishna conscious, whatever we understand as Krishna conscious, because these expressions are also like slogans, so to say. I'm not criticizing that, but sometimes for someone, Krishna conscious means a pure devotee, for someone means a bhakta of any type, for someone means something else. So also we need to clarify what do we mean by that. So on one side, I'll make that clear, hopefully, that bhakti again can arrive to any vessel in any moment. The grace of the sweet absolute is not waiting for our qualification. Our qualification is a sincere eagerness to embrace the gift, to be sincere enough to open ourselves to mercy. I always like to share the example of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's conversion. He converted to Mahaprabhu's. I wouldn't say he converted to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, because at that time there was no such a thing called Gaudiya Vaishnavism, right? So he fell in love with Mahaprabhu, let's put it that way, right? He became another madman, one more to the long army of spiritual madmen like Sri Chaitanya Dev and his companions. But at that time there was no such a thing as Gaudiya Vaishnavism per se. But he was somehow converted. He was an Advaitin before, a logician, and he became touched. And as we know from Shastra, a few days after his conversion, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even the next day, he was sleeping very early in the morning yet still, and Mahaprabhu arrives to his home very early with Jagannath Mahaprasad, which again, Mahaprasad not only is consecrated food, but also it's a way of speaking about grace. Grace food, if you want to use that term. Prasad means grace. Apart from the food, it means grace. And Jagannath, no? The Lord of the universe, that person who is embracing everyone and anyone without any discrimination, complete, unconditional, irreversible grace, extending from those big eyes, big smile, big extended arms, saying, "You are seen, you are held, you are loved." So Mahaprabhu is coming with the grace food from such a divine. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya again is still sleeping, like drooling in the bed, so to say. He hasn't had a bath, he hasn't recited any of the morning prayers that he used to do as a Brahmin, as a very paka Varnashram Brahmin, to do so many morning duties before you dare to eat anything. And Mahaprabhu jumps into his bed and just say, "Hey, look what I have. I have the grace of Jagannath Mahaprasad." And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, before being converted, he will probably have said, "Oh, I cannot take it now. First, I have to wake up, do Achaman, put tila, have a bath, recite my Sandhya Vandanam, Gayatri prayers, and only then I'm ready to honor the grace." But after being touched by divine madness, he immediately accepted Jagannath Mahaprasad right from the bed, right from the sleeping bag. He started honoring without washing mouth, wishing. And the point for me, the main point in this lila is grace cannot wait, no? For us to be ready, for us to be prepared, for us to be bathed, for us to be properly paka pure. It just grace just jumps on you, right? And if you are fortunate enough, you will say yes to that jumping on, no? So all this to say bhakti comes from bhakti. All this to say bhakti is not saying, "Oh, you are still a little bit psychologically dysfunctional, so I won't dare to get closer to you." Or, "You have this childhood trauma that you haven't yet confronted, so you are not ready for bhakti." Or whatever, right? "You are eating this, you are drinking that, you have this bad habit, you cannot be a devotee." That's not how bhakti works. And again, I'm saying this along because unfortunately, sometimes Gaudiya Vaishnavas themselves have created this culture of purity, which is very elitistic to the point that if you don't follow this and that rule, whatever that rules are in the mind of those people, the ideal standard, sorry, you are not part of Mahaprabhu's movement. You don't follow the four regulative principles, you cannot be a devotee. You don't chant 16 rounds, you cannot be a devotee. You are not renounced enough, you cannot be a devotee. Whatever, each one has their own trippy idea. But that shows a very big misunderstanding of the nature of bhakti, in which we are creating this whole almost many times impossible standards only as a preliminary stage for you to be a devotee. And that's downplaying the power and effect of bhakti, being capable to jump on our bed when we are sleeping and shower us with mercy, as this example of Sarvabhauma shows. So that's the first part of my answer or my exploration. Just trying to make that clear, right? Because sometimes I've spoken a lot and I continue to speak a lot about the importance of being humanly balanced. But sometimes I've heard about thinking, oh, but Manav Maharaj is saying that now bhakti is no longer important. It's all about emotional balance and psychology. But I never saying that. But because I'm talking about that on some level, it doesn't mean that we are canceling the nature of bhakti, but also doesn't mean that the whole other thing has to be put aside because bhakti is independent, so I can continue being completely dysfunctional and bhakti will perform miracles in me. Well, yes and no, of course. In one sense, bhakti still purifies the most dysfunctional beings, but I will say there is, and many of our acharyas have made a case for trying to lead as a sattvic life as possible, for us to take advantage of the grace of bhakti coming, because that bhakti is coming without any condition doesn't mean that we have the capacity to honor that coming of bhakti also. So sometimes this one is extremely, I'm going to an extreme, of course, but extremely disturbed due to some whatever, unresolved dysfunctionality, trauma. Sometimes that may get in the way of how to properly engage in bhakti, how to properly relate to other bhaktas. Yeah, that happens. I've seen that a lot. And I'm saying I'm free from that. So there is a case to make in terms of try to be integrated, going to that word, integrated as a human being. Again, I'm not saying perfectly, fully integrated before bhakti, what to speak, but try to live a balanced life, as Krishna speaks in the sixth chapter of the Gita. You a yogi, and you ultimately he ends up the chapter mentioning a bhakti yogi is the finest. Final yogi, so to say. So that whatever he says about the yogi applies to a bhakti yogi. And yuktahar viharasya yukta chastasya karma suyukta svapna. He's saying, right? One has to be yukta, 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 balanced, integrated, if you want to use that word, in sleeping, in eating, in whatever one does, one being awake, in whatever recreation one has. Basically, those are a few examples to say try to be balanced in all the departments of engagement during your life. It's not that in the name of bhakti and remain unhealed, unbalanced in ways that I know that I could do something about, and I take bhakti as an excuse. Bhakti is transcendental, is beyond the guna, so I don't need to deal with any of this stuff. Not necessarily, because again, which capacity do I have to understand bhakti properly? Many times, our understanding of bhakti is filtered by unresolved wounds, projections that we put onto Krishna himself as a daddy figure, as the ultimate authority figure. I've seen that a lot on the guru figure, on the disciple, on whomever, depending each case. So again, no doubt bhakti is creating its own effect, but that doesn't mean that we are absolutely beyond all conditioning. So especially as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, I will say we want to serve in this Naralila. Right, and Naralila is a unique combination of humanity and divinity. Naralila, Nara means human, and Lila somehow speaks about something divine, divine play, but it's fully human. We don't know what that is because we are not fully human yet, right? We don't know what's fully divine, but we don't know what's fully human either. So suddenly we are hearing about this fully human, fully divine reality, and we are half-baked human and half-baked divine with good fortune. So gradually we need to get integrated. I will say, as a human, it's important to be integrated humans so we can offer that integrated humanity in the service of Nara-Lila. In the Nara-Lila, I will argue you find the full presence of divinity, but also we find a fully integrated humanity in the figures of the Brajavasis, of the eternal associates of Bhagavan in the Lila. They are fully integrated human beings and fully perfected spiritual beings. So I will argue in that sense that the more I integrate my humanity here, the more I can understand the humanity of the Lila, and at the same time cultivating my spirituality in the context of being human. Again, one doesn't need to cancel the others. Somehow this false narrative got in the way at some point that to be transcendental means to neglect being human, right? And we end up with a form of disembodied spirituality, many times very dysfunctional, bodily, physically, mentally, emotionally. And we don't need to reject any of that. Again, our tradition is not about rejecting anything. Yukta Vairagya, speaking about Yukta, it's offering everything. So in that sense, not my case, but what I think what the tradition actually teaches, hopefully it's not just Swami Padmanabha's fantasy world of speculation, but I think there is a strong case to make that we should, pay attention to our health physically, mentally, emotionally, not as a self-centered, separatistic, dualistic project, but it's my sadaka deha, psychic, physical, and I take care of that. It's not me, it's not mine, it's a tool of service, so I take care of all of that in the context of proper self-love, if you will, even, and in the service of Bhagavan. So be a properly integrated human being. I will say that's akin to Satvagun. And Srila Prabhupada and other acharyas many times emphasize the importance of Satvagun. Again, bhakti can touch anyone, even if you're in the realm of Tamagun predominantly or Rajagun. But Satvagun gives clarity. It's a platform that allows for a better appreciation of what's even beyond Satvagun. Satvagun is compared to arriving to the airport, right? You want to take a flight to somewhere, as I need to do in a few days. If I want to take the flight, that's great, to transcendence, to Golok, but I have to go to the airport first. I can't expect the flight to land here on the corner of my mom's house. We'll have a problem in the neighborhood if a plane flight lands here. So I have to do my part to reach to the airport. In other words, I have to work on my Satvagun properly, balance, a balanced life. And again, the interesting thing about a balanced life in Satvagun is that Rajas and Tamas find their place in a very balanced way, because sometimes we also have stigmatized somehow Tamas and Rajas, but those are energetic, different energetic expressions that are required to do so many things. Like you cannot sleep if you don't embrace Tamaguna, right? You need Tamaguna to fall asleep. So if you don't fall asleep, if you don't sleep, you go crazy, right? After one day, 2 days, you're going nuts. So you need inertia, you need tamaguna, so you are balanced. So tamaguna plays a role in balancing your existence, if properly embraced. If you oversleep, that's another thing. That's tamasic. But if you undersleep, I will say that's tamasic as well. That's a form of balance. And Rajaguna is the principle of dynamism, of action, activation. We need all that to do so many things. So those are energies that, if properly expressed, they, again, if balanced, if sat, we can express Rajas and Sat and Tamas in a sattvic way. And all that brings further sattva, further balance. So sattva is not about only sattva and no rajas and tamas, because that's not possible. Krishna says in the Gita, whatever one guna is operating, the other two are there also. So it's not about embrace one and the other two are canceled, but embrace one in such a way that the other ones are expressed in a balanced way. And sattva also needs to be expressed in a balanced way. No, I don't know. Sometimes I could say, one could say, I'm very sattvic. I'm joking here, of course, I'm not. So I'm very sattvic, and therefore I only eat milk products, because which I don't, I almost vegan, but because milk products are in the mode of sattva gun. I are in sattva gun. But then you see my diet, and I'm eating, overeating cheese and cream, and so it's all sattvic food, but I'm eating that in a non-sattvic way. You follow? So I can invoke sattva in rajasic or tamasic ways, and I can invoke rajas and tamas in sattvic ways. So all that I mean by being an integrated human being, right? Like, because again, it's not like, oh, gunas are bodies, matter, reject all that and transcend. It's a gradual process. Of course, there is something called going beyond the gunas, but the way you go beyond the gunas is not by repressing that. Krishna himself says in the Gita, you don't gain anything by repression, but by learning to relate to those energies in a balanced way, and from that balanced place of clarity, being more capable of receiving the descent of bhakti, integrating everything properly, humanity, divinity, and eventually you have that perfect equation of fully human, fully divine. But there may be a long way to go, not that long, but a few lifetimes. So we need to do what we need to do here and now. So, and many times, yeah, talking to the bodhisattvas, I've seen that whenever they feel they are stuck or perhaps they are not advancing, many times it's not their fault, or it's not that the practice is failing them. It's just that probably there is some human issue that needs to be named and framed and addressed and healed and integrated. And it's fine. It's like, again, I'm waking up and I have a problem in my leg, and it's pain more and more painful. I mean, part of my integration is going to the doctor and doing something about the leg. It's not just I'm not my leg, and I'm transcendent. Well, probably your leg, the more as it becomes more painful, it will get in the way of your sadhana life. So the same with your psychic leg, so to say, no, whatever. So many times these things get in the way, and we need to get in the way, not because they are bad, just because we need to do something about that. We need to work on integration, which is, it's part of the journey. It's part of what it means to be a bhakta. So basically, that's what I mean. Again, without canceling the independence of bhakti that can arrive anywhere and everywhere, but also trying to bring the nuance of how, in most cases, generally, we need to work on that to some degree or another. Again, not to become obsessed with psychic healing and emotional balance to the point that bhakti becomes secondary and we forget all about it. Because if we all overtly emphasize that, there's no end to that either. You can always become a little bit more healed and a little bit more balanced. And there's no end to that, right? So you have to be balanced in trying to be balanced and not losing sight of bhakti in that context, right? So I don't know if that helps to clarify the idea. Pradhana Gopika, you tell me.
Yes, thank you so much. It helps a lot. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance of saying something again about that a few times already, and it's okay. I need myself to continue the work of integration, integral bhakti. Yeah, we can go for a few minutes to our breakout rooms, breakthrough rooms, to share about this important theme among ourselves in small groups, chambers, churning chambers, and we will return in a few minutes to continue churning together in the broader format. See you there. Okay. Welcome back. Hoping you had a good sharing, and inviting you to be even a little bit more generous than what you already are. I'd like to invite a few of you to share a few insights of what has churned in the private rooms to make it a bit more public, so to say. So let me pick a few names and invite you to share one or two words about it. 1 minute. Karuneshwari, your 1 minute jewel from the ocean.
We were speaking, I was with Prema, first time meeting her, which was really nice. And we were speaking about what a relief it is to not feel guilty every time you do something that's sort of balancing as a human. So spending time with family or doing something that's, I don't know, some exercise or whatever it is you want to do, not having to feel like you're doing something directly Krishna conscious at every single moment. And all those things that I used to feel guilty because then I was in Maya. Now we're accepting that they're part of being balanced, so that when you put conscious direct activities, you're peaceful.
Thank you. Are you hearing from the background some type of music? No. Okay, because my mom left the house and left the phone, and it has there's some alarm that is not never stopping. So I will invite someone else to share, and I will wake up for a minute and turn that off because that will be there for the next 1 hour and a half. Meanwhile, let's invite who can we invite? Let's invite Badra. And I'm still hearing, but I'm going to turn off the
Yeah.
phone.
Sorry about everyone. Wow, that was I was just saying I was sharing with Patrak Prabhu and Anuradha, and we were discussing about how the idea of thinking that we had to be perfect to be Krishna conscious was a big thing in my youth. I think in my youth in bhakti, I mean. And I, just as an example, I would have some soy milk on my kitchen bench, and I'd feel embarrassed if a devotee walked in and saw the soy milk, because soy milk was supposed to, it was something, it was a no-no for devotees. Soy was a no-no, thinking that I, and so that was one thing that involved what people thought of me. But apart from that, what I thought of myself was that I had to be perfect. I had to be always Krishna conscious. All that you do, all that you eat, all that you offer and give away. And I didn't realize that these things take lifetimes to develop. And really, when you first come into bhakti, the idea is to take these things into your understanding, but not necessarily pressure yourself to be at that high standard all the time. And that's the way it was in my youth, in bhakti. So the more I hear about this, the more I like it. I get a little bit more clear about it every time I hear Maharaj describe these things.
Thank you, Badra, for sharing. And yeah, that's very interesting how sometimes we one receive like as a preliminary thing, you have to be perfect, right? It's like it's you cannot get more extreme than that, right? You have first to be perfect and then practice bhakti. I mean, you have to attain something that probably is attainable in lifetimes before starting the whole thing. Something like that, right? So it's a little bit
Yeah,
particular,
yes.
particular sequence of
Yeah.
order.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It def
I cannot hear you.
I like Patraka was saying that we it's kind of presented like that oftentimes, at least it was in those days, because the those who were doing the presenting were they were neophytes as well, they and it was like it was presented that we have to be the full quid right from the start. So yeah.
Yeah, and also the misleading again, that perfection, preliminary perfection, maybe was not made in terms of you have to be perfect in terms of divine love, but you have to be perfect in terms of moral purity or something like that. Which again reduces bhakti to something dependent on moral purity, which is in itself a whole apasiddhanta, the whole misleading, right? Like moral purity is above bhakti. So anyhow, not to blame anyone. That's how we humans filter revelation with our own biases and unresolved stuff and how we pass them on. And it's always good to continue healing the parampara of toxic interpretation with the proper parampara of healing interpretation, which, yeah, it's fine. It's everywhere. It's part of the deal. It's part of the journey. Okay, let's move forward to the next question or doubt or topic to explore. And the next raised hand comes from India with Abhinandana. So welcome. You can unmute yourself, Abhinandana.
Pranam Maharaj. So I was listening to this podcast you had with Pastor Scarlett, and she was
Sorry.
talking Pastor Scarlet.
I cannot hear well. Scarlet?
Can you hear
No.
me?
Scarlet.
Huh.
What's Scarlet?
Yeah.
Okay. Pastor. Yeah. Sorry. Scarlet Gordon. Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me now, Maharaj?
Yeah.
So she was talking about how she ha handles difficult situations, and she said she recognizes that she's not enduring this alone. And she said one line that touched me. She said, "The Lord is going with me through this." And I just wanted to ask you what are the full implications of that, because that was very beautiful. And a few other things that she said, "I don't see it as pain or suffering, but I see it as an experience that helps me grow in love for God." And then and I thought about it, I felt like, yeah, that comes through practice, because I mean, at least for now, I can only see things as pain or suffering and not as an experience themselves. But yeah, this line that she said, that the Lord is going with me through this, it was very, I just wanted to ask you about that.
Thank you. And yes, Scarlett is a dear friend, of course. We have visited her every year almost, and we did some interfaith gatherings at her space. She's very favorable. She's the one who wants to make an interfaith parikram to Jagannath Puri with her Christian friends to explore possibility of Jesus visiting India and things like that. So we'll see what happens with that. And we did that podcast some years ago already. So I do not recall, of course, all the details of it. I remember it was at Namrasa's place. So we had the background of the Namrasa podcast, but it's my podcast, not his. But he lent the space very generously because we met in New Jersey. So yeah, she knowing Scarlett. It doesn't surprise me that she said what she said, what you just mentioned, Abhinandana, and she's a very, how to say, a person of deep faith and deep trust and deep abiding in God's protection. You can see how she moved through life and how life moves through her very naturally. She's a very, surrendered person, I will say. So that's very present in our tradition, of course, right? I mean, especially in the context of suffering as well, the notion that we are not enduring whatever we are enduring alone, anything, not only suffering, right? I know that with suffering it's more difficult, but because when we are having a great time, we don't care so much if God is there or not, because we're having a great time. So, but when we are suffering, then where is Krishna? And even if he's not here, I will blame him. But when I'm having a great time, maybe Krishna better don't mess up with me now. I'm having a great time. So sometimes that's funny, right? Because in the moments of joy, we don't want God so much involved, and in the moments of suffering, we may doubt if he's involved and if he is, we are kind of demanding his presence. Not all of us, but sometimes we resort to this. And proper ways of approaching the divine in either of these two circumstances. But yeah, I mean, just ontologically beginning with the idea of God as a witness, right? The other day I was writing a poem about Antariyami as Paramatma, God in the heart, as the one who is bearing witness, right? Bearing witness. It's Sakshitva in Sanskrit. No? He who is bearing witness of everything that is happening. And again, we're bearing witness doesn't mean watching out and taking notes so the Jamadutas have the proper account at the end of your life. No, that's not bearing witness. Okay? Bearing witness as a well-wisher, as a friend, as a very well-wishing friend, Suhrit, that's the word that is repeatedly used in Shastra, which means kind of a heart friend. Right, unconditionally heart friend. That's God in everyone's heart. Now, here we are not even talking about the Bhakta and Bhagavan reciprocating with the Bhakta in a particular way. That's on another level. But on a more foundational, universal level, Paramatma, which is not a separate person as Bhagavan, is in everyone's heart, is in everyone, it's in everyone's atom, it's in every atom, as a friend who is bearing witness to what's unfolding, and is trying to accompany everything and everyone in the most well-wishing form possible. And this is difficult for us to imagine, but I think we just should exercise our imagination to conceive of such a thing. Now, sometimes we don't have a good relationship with the word imagination because we may think, oh, that's speculative and that belongs to the realm of non-factual untruth. But some truths are so profound that we need to explore our imagination to try to conceive what that must be. For example, what I'm talking about now, right? The sweet absolute is bearing witness to every unfolding of our life with compassion and love, and trying to invoke the most positive possible influence at any given moment. That generally sounds too good to be true. So we need to exercise the imagination, not to invent something, but to try to conceive something that is the most real of the most real. But generally, the things that are the most real are too vast to comprehend. So they overwhelm us. We cannot think about the things. They are not thinkable stuff. Like Meister Eckhart will say in Christianity, if you can think it, it's not God, right? So we can share thoughts and ideas, but you cannot think God. The moment you have thought God, it's no longer God. It's an object of your thinking capacities. And God can never be reduced to your thinking capacities. That's why one name of the divine is Adokshaya, which means he who lies way beyond the reach of mind, senses, rationality, empiric capacities. So it's a mystery in many ways. It's a perpetual mystery. There are things we can say about the mystery, but you can never say enough. So all this to say that, yeah, we especially in the context of surrender, Sharanagati, we will say, Gop Tri Tui Varanam Rakshishati Tivishva, so Gop Tri Tui Varanam. The crux, the marrow of surrender is trust that you are being protected by Krishna and that you are being maintained by the divine. No matter what, no matter the circumstance, try to enter in. And again, this is not just a one-liner to memorize, but to think about it, to feel it, to experience it. I'm being protected, I'm being maintained, I'm being accompanied. Even in the worst chapters of my life, I won't say even especially in the worst chapters, because it may sound like, oh, then God will appear when I'm suffering the most, and then he won't be that present. No, he's unconditionally equally present everywhere and every time, including those worst moments. So suffering, yeah, we do not re deny the reality of suffering, right? We don't want to how to say, to downplay the effect of suffering, even if we could say, well, suffering is something you perceive in your mind, you ultimately material suffering doesn't touch the soul. I get the point. But in the experience we are all having, we do go through experiences of suffering. So we shouldn't repress them, downplay them, but also do not reduce the whole suffering experience to just suffering, which many times that's the problem. The problem is that when we are suffering, we isolate ourselves in that chamber of suffering so we can only see suffering. We lose sight that we are not suffering alone, which is the main point that Scarlett made, the first one. When you forget that you are not suffering alone, when you think I'm suffering alone, probably the only thing that remains is suffering. You become overwhelmed by the experience. You think you are alone, forgotten, isolated, disconnected, not belonging. So the suffering takes over. And you lose sight of so many more things that are there and happening at the same time. So I will say that one of the very first things we need to do when we are suffering is to follow what Scarlett say, which is you are not suffering alone, which we speak many times, right? It's not my suffering, it's our suffering. It's more of a universal condition. That's how the Bhagavad Gita starts, right? Vishada yoga, the yoga of despair, trying to normalize something that happens to all of us. And again, we could philosophize that from the enlightened perspective, what you are perceiving as suffering is not that. I get it, but if you are not there, you cannot just bully people into transcendence, right? If someone can say, Swami, I'm suffering because my girlfriend left me, I cannot just bring philosophy and smash the Bhagavatam on top of that person's head saying, from the ultimate perspective of eternity, that's not happening. So relax. That's violence to do that, right? So we should be compassionate enough to be relatable and inhabit the situation as empathically as we can. But again, it's important to create this experience of you are not alone in this. That gives some air, that gives some breathing space, some spaciousness to hold the situation in a way that is not as suffocating as we may perceive it if it's just us suffering all along, no? So, and when we realize I'm not suffering alone, God is with me, He's in my heart, He's bearing witness, He's making, creating the best possible influence for me, but also I have to do my part. Again, it's not that I'm just passively waiting for Krishna to do magic and then I'm out of suffering. Because at the end of the day, again, suffering many times is not so much what happens to us, but how we go through what happens to us. As once I was talking to a friend, and we were one of the ways you can describe suffering is, and again, I'm talking in general. No, I know there are situations, and I don't want to sound insensitive by that, but in many ways, we could also speak about suffering as a contraction of consciousness. Big parts of our suffering are because our consciousness is not expanded enough. So we see from a very contracted place. Again, like I'm suffering alone. That's contracted consciousness. That's not the full picture because you are not suffering alone. So if you feel I'm suffering alone, that's a form of contracted consciousness, of partial perception, which creates its own misery. So expanding consciousness there will be give space to someone else to be there with you. You are not alone in your suffering. That doesn't mean that the suffering goes away, but you are experiencing it from a different place. I'm not alone here. God is in my heart. And not only sometimes it's not even enough to say, it's okay, God is in your heart. You are not alone. Rather than saying that yourself to someone, you should embody how God in your heart will feel for you and what He will be saying, right? Rather than, it's fine, you are not alone in your suffering. Krishna is with you in your heart. Good luck. No, you should become Krishna, so to say, for that person at that moment, right? So to go through suffering or through loss, through betrayal, through everything in life, in community, right? That's way more holistic and healthy. And we have more chances to learn the lesson and integrate our experiences because we are all day having experiences, but that doesn't mean we are becoming experienced people because of the experiences we have. If we are not learning the lessons, if we are going through them numbed or evasive and running away from them, we are not probably learning much. So we need a particular vessel to hold. To acknowledge the experience to begin with, right? Someone to validate what you are going through. It's okay. It's part of life. It's not bad. You are not bad. It's part of the journey. You don't need to condemn yourself for that. You don't need to isolate yourself in that. No, normalize it. Acknowledge and normalize the condition. Share it in community. And again, I'm not saying the suffering disappear, but and some particular wounds may be there for years, for a lifetime. But you are dealing with them in a way that is opening your heart, leaving your heart. It's like an open wound. It's an open heart in this case. An open wound can create an open heart, more receptive, more willing, more empathic, more sensitive, so you can gain so much treasures from that. Again, suffering is a very, how to say, a big door opener in many ways. Remember one person saying how he will meet a lady, an elder lady. She will smile very brightly and she will lit the whole room up with her smile. It was so inspiring. And he will go and ask her, like, why, like something like, how can you smile in that way, right? What's behind that smile? And she say, well, I've cried a lot. I've suffered a lot. No. That was her answer, interestingly enough. Right? So someone that enters deeply in touch with her suffering can also express her smile or any other emotion for that case in deep, profound human ways. But generally, if we, and this is something that Brené Brown mentions, touching with some previous topics from the previous exploration about human integration, but if you numb some particular emotion, generally the numbing is not selective. So it's not like I will numb this emotion but leave all the others fully active. Generally, you numb all of them, at least to some degree. It's not that the numbing is only 100%. So the point is, on the contrary, when you dare to open yourself to whatever comes as a visitor, be it suffering or whatever, and you are open to the contact, that probably that will open you and make you more willing to contact every other single emotion or experience, which are many, right? It's not just sad, happy, fearful. Sometimes we're quite reductionistic and we have three, four words to name that, which in itself speaks the need we have to become more fluent, more articulate in naming what's going on. Many times the culture, many times the spiritual culture has not done a good job naming the inner landscape of the heart. And we became very reductionistic, if not utterly dismissive, canceling that whole thing, because transcendence is the only thing. So gradually we may need to, because eventually you realize, oh, but now I'm exploring the, in the name of transcendence, I'm canceling all my emotionality. And the more I get acquainted with how transcendence looks like for us Gaudiya Vaishnavas, I realize it's full of emotionality. And on so much detail, so much nuance. And again, I'm not saying it's one thing is the same as the other, but at the same time, there is enough commonality for us to start here having some point of reference with our own experience as humans. So we can start to have some idea of what they are talking about in terms of eternal emotions. Because again, if I am a fully dysfunctional human with all my emotions numbed, probably I've heard about the emotions in Golok and I'm not getting it. There is a big abyss in between, a limbo. No, so our plan is not going to limbo. So yeah, I will say it's important to, in moments of pain and suffering, to understand I'm not going through this alone, and to look for community also, to community, and community maybe one more person. Again, let's not over idealize community in numerical terms. There have to be 108. No, as we were talking recently, we did a podcast on grieving with Jai Jagannath Prabhu, and we were talking that some of the things generally you cannot bear them alone, but also you cannot share them in a massive gathering either. Right? You cannot do it with 100 people, you cannot do it with yourself alone. So you need some amount of people. Sustain it, maybe one more or two or three, not many. And that may be your community. And they are bearing witness to your situation, hopefully with empathy, hopefully with openness, not trying to correct, not trying to fix, right? Just bearing witness. Chakshi Twa. That's another very sattvic quality to cultivate. The learning to listen, to receive, to bear witness. And trusting that we are being accompanied at every moment. Sometimes we may lose sight of that. Of course, sometimes we may lose the experience and of we are being held in God's unconditional love. It's easy to talk about it, but in practice, sometimes we may lose sight of that. So again, we may need a more concrete embodiment of that in another human being, in another person, another entity, to embody that for us, so we do not end up in a lonely chamber, jail, thinking I'm going through this all by myself, because in that case that can feel like too much. So that's a huge step. And it's all tied to Sharanagati again, right? The essence of Sharanagati is living your life as if, I'm not saying as if like a blind belief that is not true, but how in an experience, because that's what Jiva Goswami says, Sharanagati is the outer expression of Shraddha or of divine faith. And faith is not blind belief, right? Faith is based on some experience. So you have an experience, develop this conviction, and that plays out in your life, living a life of trust, on knowing you are accompanied, that you are not alone. We can always reinforce that experience for sure and nourish it. And sometimes we may need that more than other times, more than ever. So that's Sadhu Sangha as well. That's an expression of Sadhu Sangha. Guhyam akyati prichati. Disclosing our hearts in secrecy, in intimacy, in vulnerability, and being bore witness by intimate fellowship. Yeah, we all need that. I hope that helps. You tell me, Abhinandana.
Yes, Maharaj, that is very kind. I mean, I've never heard the way you voice things. They're very kind. And then this one part that you talked about how to that Krishna is a witness who is a person who's a friend, loves you unconditionally, and sometimes that can overwhelm us. I felt that, and yeah, it, and I was just thinking that these prompts in your books, they are really helpful. So I just thought, what would you say as a prompt to imagine something like that?
Yeah, it's just again, as I said before, we have to exercise our imagination. Again, imagination doesn't mean science fiction. Imagination is expanding our capacity to conceive something that is true, real, but that we are just conceiving it in relatively small ways still. So we can always expand that, dare to imagine. Sit with the idea. Sit with the idea. You are being loved unconditionally, no matter what. No? And it's challenging because, again, probably many times comes the voices that that's not true, you are worthless, you do not deserve that, you are bad. Not all this type of all these voices of toxic shame, and one needs to sit with that and confront those voices and bring a more powerful voice of conditional love and acceptance till we get to that point of experiencing that. And of course, when we have a glimpse of that, it's easier to know that's true, it's easier to conceive about that on some degree. But even if we have an experience of that, we just have been touched by the drop of that ocean. So we can always sit and try to, not with our head, but try just to sit with that reality, no? Unconditional love. It's the glue sustaining, holding everything together. And what comes from that? Praying, opening in prayer to see what's revealed about that. No, again, not trying to think our way out to that, because it's beyond thinking. But it's good to sit with those things that go beyond thinking, and not trying to think about them. Just staying with the reality of those things and allowing those things to touch us beyond thinking, beyond any capacity. Because again, that's the thing with unconditional love, that it's beyond all our capacities. We cannot earn it, we cannot deserve it, we cannot think it, we cannot colonize it, we cannot measure it, control all, which are all the ways we move in the world. Both for many of us, that's what life is. Right? Survival of the fittest, and moving and calculating and measuring and controlling and colonizing and understanding and thinking, and then you are brought something that is not subject to any of that. So it's absolutely like unsettling, And we need to sit with that unsettling, which is the most wonderful, beautiful thing. And generally, the most wonderful, beautiful things are the most unsettling because they invite us outside the comfort zone and to a place where we cannot control, to a place where we can only serve, we can only give ourselves, we can only bear witness to that higher reality, right? In the words of Srila Siddharma, she says, we want to enter into a land when we will be walking with our heads on the ground, because everything will be made of a higher substance than ourselves. So everything will be vulnerable for us. So we won't be walking with our foot, but with our head. No, like everything is above our head. So that's what we do with our head, but something's above our head. That's what Brahma did in the Bhagavatam. Jnana prayasam udapasya namantayeva. No, he tried to think Krishna, he tried to think the Leela, he tried to understand, and his forehead started to spin like crazy at one point. It was too much for Brahma. He prayed, Jnana prayasam udapasya, this attempt of capturing everything through knowledge through the head, udapasya. I reject that utterly. And instead, namantayeva, I do namaste, namaskar. I put my head on the ground. I will gain way more knowledge through my head by putting my head on the ground, that I'm trying to think out unconditional love and all these higher realities. So, yeah, sitting with that, not trying to think, to solve, to fix, to get it, and gradually we will learn the language of that world where we don't need to measure and control anything, and it's okay, and there's no danger. On the contrary, yeah. Okay, thank you. And thank you, Scarlett, for triggering this whole exchange, though she's not here today, but we'll let her know. Okay, we can go a few more minutes to the breakout room and see you back. Please share about your whatever you would like to share in connection to what we just spoke about, and see you soon back. Welcome. Welcome back, you all. You had a good time in the churning rooms, and let's invite a few of you to share a few 1 minute jewels discovered from the ocean of your churning together. Sam, what's there to share? Be generous.
Okay, I was with the lovely Rasangi, and we were talking about meeting people where they are and and holding space for somebody, but without getting absorbed in trying to fix it or trying to fix many people's problems at once, but being able to sort of hold the tension between supporting but accepting that level of mandatory responsibility that everyone carries. We can't take on someone else's life. We can't carry them. We support them and help them as much as we can, but we can't carry them through everything. So yeah, that was, and yeah, that was our very, very illuminating conversation. Hare
Thank
Krishna.
you. Thank you. Who else we can invite? Manjulali Manjari. Invited.
Oh gosh, I wasn't expecting you to pick me, but I guess what I was reflecting on what you were saying about how suffering, and you can't just block one emotion out, and if you block one, you're blocking everything. And I was reflecting on a patient that I supported where her younger brother and mother were murdered, and in order to kind of connect with the grief and the suffering, it was just too painful. And therefore, what happened is she wasn't able to connect with any of the wonderful memories that she'd wanted to connect with in terms of her younger brother. So I was just reflecting on how a lot of suffering is, you have to get to that point of acceptance as well, isn't it? when you get to acceptance and you're not
Yeah.
fighting reality. You have to accept reality as it is, and then you can kind of lean into the situation or the journey that is present before you. But on the other hand, those defenses or blocking out reality can be helpful as well in order to kind of get through a particular situation. But it's knowing when you have to let go and actually kind of enter the journey, and by coming out the other
Yeah.
side, then somehow the perception can shift.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Very important nuance to remain compassionate in the midst of the storm, right? Sometimes we can say accept what's going on, but acceptance is a process unto itself, right? Like our tradition speaks, accepting initiation, but that's not a one act performance. It's a whole process of accepting that you have lost this or you have this emotion. It's not just like a 1 minute epiphany, but ongoing process. And once, probably once we have accepted and are working through that, eventually we realize that we're invited to accept that that's happening yet on another level and on another level, and so many refined levels of acceptance. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, let's invite next raise hand, digital raise hand, which came from Kanupriya from Scotland, I mean from Switzerland in Scotland probably. So invited to unmute and present your offering. Welcome, Kanupriya.
Hare Krishna. And thank you for another opportunity to ask the question. Actually, since a longer time, I am with this question. It has to do with the process of offering bhoga. And I realize more and more that I would like to walk an authentic path, which means whatever I do, and whatever I try to express in a way of serving, like offering food, I like it has to also come from my heart and has to make sense in a way that there is a background, a strange sound. Is that with everyone?
That's fine. That's fine.
I realize that when I prepare the food or the bhoga on the plate, I have all these nice little plates then to bring to the altar. More and more, I feel something is not right here for me. Why do I place food on a separate plate? And then after that, I wash it separately, separate sponge, separate towel to clean. It feels so, I create like a distance between me and Radha Krishna. Because if a good friend comes to my house, I take out the nicest plate I have from my plates, and I would place everything on that plate and give it to the friend because that's my nicest plate I have and I like to share. So I feel every time I do this separation with the offering plates, I feel like I create a distance, not a coming closer. And maybe
So
I.
your offering plates are not the nicest ones you have at home.
I don't use them for myself, but I would use things I use for my closest ones, not. It's just a feeling I have, and I don't know how to explain, but this feeling is telling me I need either to understand it deeper, why we do it in this way. If at the very end we are in such an intimate relationship, so why do I create rituals which create, right now I have a feeling of separance, not coming close. So that's one part. And the other part is also while cooking. Right now we're in a very stressful situation in life. A lot is going on, and there are moments where I feel I do not really have enough time then to offer properly. So I also try already while I'm cooking to send out a thought, please, Radha Krishna, accept this bhoga. And then I truly have a feeling it's already accepted in that moment. I have a feeling Radha Krishna don't have to have this time of considering, yeah, or accepting, or however this whole ritual we create. I do see a meaning and a sense in it, but I also truly believe it's in a blink of an eye or in a microsecond when the thought goes out, please accept it is accepted. So these two things are in my head right now, and I would love to hear your thoughts because I like to understand better. Right now, I feel not in peace with the whole offering process.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And probably, yeah, whatever you shared, you are not alone in that idea, in that sharing, or in that lack of peace, so to say, which is not a problem. Again, there's no problem with you. There's no problem with offering the bhoga. There's no problem with Radha and Krishna, right? So, first of all, let's all relax for a moment. Oh, everything's okay. and as we always speak, right? There are rituals, but the word ritual is not a bad word. It's how we approach the ritual. How if we the ritual can be a facilitator of intimacy, or a ritual can be an obstacle and create an abyss and make everything mechanical. But that's not the original intention of the ritual. So again, it's not that because we want to serve Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan and we're on the path of Raga Nuga Bhakti, which we are officially in, doesn't mean that we do reject all rituals because we don't have anything to do with rituals. What we do not embrace is doing the rituals in ways that are mechanistic, without understanding why, creating unnecessary distance. But we can do everything with a proper approach, right? Which doesn't mean that we will do every single ritual. There are so many rituals you can possibly do, you don't have the whole time per day. But I think there is a place to acknowledge the power of ritual, no? The power of, I don't know, creating some sacred time and sacred space. As we tell sometimes you need to create a sacred space, no? Like, I don't know, you want to invoke certain particular state of consciousness, you light some candles, you see the nature. At the same time, it's not that Krishna will become more present because you did that. No? Radha and Krishna are omnipresent, right? But we are omniabsent, right? So we need to make adjustments to gradually gain awareness. Oh, this is a sacred moment. Every moment is a sacred moment. This is sacred space. Every space is a sacred space, but we are not there in terms of realization. So rituals can be very powerful conveyors of that if properly addressed. If not, as that's what Rupa Goswami says, the fourth verse of, sorry, third verse of, not second verse of Upadeshamrita, which is Niyamagraha, which has two applications. And these two applications are unfavorable to bhakti. One is following all rules and regulations or all rituals without knowing why, right? Like mechanically, without a feeling, without an investment of the heart. That's unfavorable, he says. Don't do it. But also, another reading of Niyamagraha means rejecting all rules and regulations and rituals whimsically. He says, don't do that either, right? Sometimes we go from one extreme to the other of the pendulum. So, of course, some of us may need to stop doing some things or even rituals. There's a proper place to not do some things, and there's a proper place to do some things. So regarding the offering, I will say, of course, the whole process of offering the bhoga is about developing this sense of intimacy and relationality and interaction with the divine. So whatever we do, and I'm not saying just invent your own thing, but we have to do it in a way that that's happening, right? Not that we become like obsessed with the technicalities of it. Oh, the plate has to be this size, and the tulsi leaf has to go on this part, and this has to, because if not, right? If not, what will happen? Radha Krishna will not accept it. There will be offense. Whatever I will be eating is sin personified. Long list of stuff, which is not healthy. So there are, in the context of that, there are different ways to do that. I will say regarding the plate situation, I think there is a way of understanding. I mean, I'm not here to tell you what to do, but one way one could under relate to the special plate for Radha and Krishna in a way that doesn't create like separateness will be like, I don't know, probably we all have plates at home for our dear ones also. Maybe there is. Maybe not. Maybe sometimes in home there are general plates and everyone picks the same plate, everyone. But sometimes you have a, I know you had your child and you have a plate for your child which has its name on it, or a cup with a picture. My mom has a cup with a picture of her dog here. I think she uses it's not for the dog in this case. Anyhow. So and it's her own plate and her own cup or so there is a sweetness there, right? It's not necessarily ritualistic. It's not that if my mom has a plate with my name on it, that will create distance between us. It may even create, hopefully, intimacy. Oh, look, this plate is your plate. It's for you. It has your name on it. So it gives a chance of making a special investment of your intention. That plate becomes like a representation of the person, so to say. Even if the person is not at home, you see the plate and, oh, no. Like if you see the shoes of your daughter, so to say, at home, but she's somewhere else, but they are act like Udipana, like some stimulant triggering, like, oh. So for me, that will be a way to relate to the plates, no, for the altar. It's not something like, oh, there, this is not my own plates, I'm creating some distance. No, it can be a way of these are the plates that I've crafted or got for my beloveds and you can relate to all that in a way that is intimate. That say, I'm not forcing you to do it in that way. I'm just offering like an alternative way of relating to those plates, to give an example among so many other things, right? And one can relate to that in a very sweet way, right? I have again, we have special items reserved for special people in our lives many times, and it's not that I'm being, I don't know, sectarian with other people because I'm not giving them the place that I have for my beloved or for my child. There is some particular investment of the heart in that direction or the other, right? So that can be endearing. And regarding that will be some ideas regarding the first part of the question that I hope it helps. But I'm not saying that's the only way, again. And regarding the second part of the question, which I totally understand and for turn in terms of practicality and dynamics, sometimes one may not be offering everything in the place in the altar. I mean, I do not do that almost any time because I'm traveling so much. I don't carry an altar with me. I have some pictures. So yeah, you can. I mean, the essence is to offer not the food, as we always say. The essence is to offer ourselves. So I always like to remind, right? We sometimes think, oh, I'm offering this potato to Krishna, so I'm doing a favor to this potato because this potato has material energy. Again, I'm being a little sarcastic here, which is this mundane falling stuff, and I'm spiritualizing the potato but consecrating it in the altar. So I'm thinking I'm doing a favor to the whole of creation, right? I'm the deliverer of the potato deliverer. Well, actually, it's the other way around we could make the case. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says material energy is a Vaishnavi of a higher order. The whole matter is personified in Maya Devi, and she's considered a Vaishnavi totally surrendered to Krishna. So, in one sense, matter is already engaged in Krishna's service while I'm not. So, rather than me offering the potato and doing the potato a favor, the potato is doing me a favor. By the grace of the potato, I can offer myself to Krishna. By the grace of matter, I can offer myself. So that's from an important point in terms of bhoga, because sometimes we become obsessed with the end result, with the ritual and the technicality and the end result. All the formula was perfect. Okay, now we can eat properly, but we forgot to offer ourselves throughout all that process. We forgot that we are still bhoga. We haven't become prasad ourselves. We are still half baked. So if during the process of cooking and off and everything you are trying to pray and offer yourself, that's it. No, if there was not special play, not bell ringing, not this nor that, I mean, that's secondary in one sense. That's an external ritual that is there to help for us to offer ourselves. But if the self, the offering of the self is already taking place, everything else falls in the category of a supporting role, so to say, that may be there or may not be there. So the important thing here is to differentiate between principles and details, right? Because what's the principle here and what's the detail? When we mess the two in the other way around, then we have a problem. And we become obsessed with the technicalities of the details that we have made the principle, and we forget the principle of offering our own heart. And when you're offering your own heart, many times the details may vary, may not be there. Again, I'm not saying this to imitate this at home, but the ultimate example of Bhoga offering is Vidura's wife giving Krishna a banana peel. I mean, you cannot get more extreme than that. No special plate, no bell ringing, no mantras, not even something that you will dare to offer anyone, right? The banana peel you throw out to the compost. And she's given that to Bhagavan. And on top of that, he's not only putting the hands and receiving the peel and saying thank you, he's eating the peel. And on top of that, he's asking for more. Which, of course, the lesson is Krishna is not eating any banana peel. He's eating bhakti all through. No? He's not seeing if it's banana peel, if it's samosa, if it's laddu. He's blind. Love is blind. So he's blind to all those technicalities. He's seeing bhakti. Krishna's diet is based on bhakti. So yeah, I don't know if that helps to support your current dynamics and lack of peace with the offering department.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. Really, it helped a lot. And I think I will go and find a nice plate, which really I feel is a plate I would use for a visitor, not the one I bought in India. Thank
And
you.
one more thing in that connection, because you gave the example a few times of a place for a visitor. In this case, we don't want Radha and Krishna to be mere visitors, right? So just they are not occasionally coming, but ideally they are there forever, always. So, but
Absolutely.
yeah, I totally get it. Find a place. So that's what sometimes Rupa Goswami will say and Uddhava in the Bhagavatam. Offer Krishna what he likes, rather than Krishna what they like the most, or also you can offer them what you like the most. And in this case, I'm thinking, okay, offer rather than Krishna the plate you like the most, but you like the most for them. No?
Absolutely. I
So
love it.
there is a way of connecting what you feel, oh, this is the most beautiful thing I could possibly get, but it's not like a selfish thing for yourself, so to say.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. That helps a lot.
Thank
Thank
you. Thank you. I'm seeing Manjula Manjari raising her hand. Or Elijah, you have a question or a comment related to what we just shared?
you.
Or is something else, just for me to know?
So it's just a different question.
A different question.
Yeah.
Okay, just for me to know. Okay. But we also had Rasangi raising her hand before. So let's see, Rasangi. Will you dare to give permission to Elijah to make
Of
his
course.
question?
Of course. Yes. Yes.
Yes, thank you, Rasangi. Okay, Elijah, welcome.
Hare Krishna, please accept my humble obeisances. Recently we've been very interested in like the underlying unity amongst different faiths. And one such one was in Sikhism. There's, I think, in the final chapter of the Guru Granth Sahib, it mentioned, like Guru Nanak mentions that one should chant the holy names of Vishvambara. And we were just wondering, because like online there wasn't much information around the interconnectedness between Sikhism and Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And we were wondering, because of your theology background, if you could maybe like elaborate or give some like illuminations between them. Thank
Well,
you.
thank you. I appreciate the question, and of course, I appreciate every genuine in attraction to whatever we may call interfaith, or as I like to call theological cross-pollination, or perennialism. Sometimes that's a word. And I was thinking, when you mentioned Sikhism and Gaudiya Vaishnavism, something that is mentioned in the book of what's his name? Satyaraj Prabhu. There is a book about Sri Chaitanya. There are many, but one he published some time ago. And there is some possibility, although we may never be able to prove that, but that Guru Nanak and Mahaprabhu met. I mean, they seem to be contemporaries, according to what he was saying. To be honest, I'm not here any scholar of Sikhism, so I don't want to speak beyond my pay grade, so to say. But he mentions there the possibility again of meeting them meeting. I think they were born, I think Guru Nanak was born like 20 years before Mahaprabhu. So they were all basically contemporaries. Sikhism emerged, I think, in Punjab in India. Gaudiya Vaishnavism emerged, even though it was not known as such at the time, in Bengal, in Orissa. So there are somehow related areas, even geographically, so to say. And somehow, both we could say were participating in some type of larger devotional renaissance, which was taking place. Not only there, even in the West, we could also explore Abrahamic traditions and what was going on in Europe at that time with Christian mystics and so on. But speaking about Sikhism and Gaudiya Vaishnavism, I could draw some of those parallels. There is a devotional element, there is an element of sacred song shared in both. In fact, I think, if, again, I'm talking as much as I know and as much as I can recall, and I may be wrong, so you will feel free to correct me. But I think Guru Nanak's main teaching sometimes is related to what we'll call Nam Japa, right? Chanting the divine name, remembering the divine name. Of course, they speak a lot about Seva as well, which is very important for us, service, remembrance. I think they also have this remembrance of the divine, like contemplation, recalling the presence of the divine, which I think sometimes we do not engage much in that, as we were talking before about the imagination and the importance of, again, not imagination in terms of creating something that is not existing, but again, contemplating divine possibilities. Just thinking about Krishna's unconditional love, that's a type of smarana, staying with that situation, with that idea, and trying to, as much as our faculties allow us, to contemplate those realities. Again, both traditions are profoundly musical. Sikh practices center around kirtan. I don't know how they call it specifically, but they maybe sangeet, some Hindu word for singing, for song. So they sing and they sit, like we sit in sankirtan as an assembly, participating in the sacred presence of the holy word or the sacred name, the holy name. Sankirtan is central for us. No need for me to clarify how important that is for the followers of Mahaprabhu. And how the name, again, name is not just a symbol, right? Name is not just an indicator of the divine, but is God itself. I think they use this word Sat Nam. I have a friend, actually one of my main friends from my teenage years. She's from Argentina, but she now lives in the US, and she's basically part of the Sikh tradition. So I've learned some from that, from her as well. So you speak about Sat Nam, which also means like the true name, right? The real name. That's not necessarily limiting to one name, but the name being true, the name being non-different from the ultimate true. We will say Nam Nam Abhinatvam Namanam, you know. Between the name and the name, there is no difference. And also the Guru Granth Sahib, the scripture that you referred to, I think they refer to different names that are common to our ways of addressing the sweet absolute, like Hari, Ram. I think Govinda as well, maybe some others. Though now there is some nuance, of course, because we are not exactly the same tradition, of course. Generally, I will say, and again, I'm not an expert, and I'm sure there's nuance here and maybe sub branches, but mostly at the end, the conception of the ultimate realization is more formless. So the name of this. Then these names of God eventually point to some more type of impersonal realization. And I'm not saying that disparagingly, just trying to make clear what I think is their main conception of the ultimate reality. And also, of course, what else? Some other differences. You refer to the Guru Granth Sahib, which means that at one point they had this parampara in Sikhism. One guru after another, but at one point, one particular guru established that from now onward, the Shastra or the book called Guru Granth Sahib is the guru for everyone. So that's some form of Ritvikism of some sorts, we will say. Not criticizing it, just saying we have a different approach to that. For us, parampara is a living, ongoing thing, though we find some Gaudiya Vaishnavas who somehow. Prefer to stop the parampara in Srila Prabhupada, for example, and say from now on there's nobody else coming and the parampara ended there, so to say. And we can go to his books, which will be some kind of parallel with the Guru Granth Sahib in this case. But that's actually not the Gaudiya Vaishnava teaching. What else? I think also Sikhism is speaking about rituals a moment ago, they're criticized a lot like overt ritualism, caste pride, which again goes hand by hand with Mahaprabhu's own critique, or I don't know, asceticism for the sake of asceticism. Again, too much over identification with the external form of the rites. And similarly, Bhava Grahi Janardana, we will say. Janardana sees the essence of one's offering and action, and that's it. So those are a few ideas that come to my mind at this moment. Again, as you can see, there are some things in similar, some things that are not so similar, and that's what happens when you explore any tradition, actually, right? So I think there is a beauty in that exercise. I'm having in 2 days a podcast with someone, a scholar from perennialism, which is a particular tradition of many, which proposed this idea that all these main wisdom lineages contain the truth, and each one expresses them from their own particular vantage point. So I think there is a lot to explore and to heal and to gain from that, and to stay with that creative tension, right? We share so much in common, and also we have differences, but we have so much in common. So keeping all in place and navigating the oneness and difference simultaneously. I don't know if that helps, Elijah. You tell me.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your enlightenment. Like we kind of knew a bit about the impersonalism, but we part about the Satnam. Is that how you say it? Satnam. That was something new. So, thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. Okay, so we have 10 minutes to five, at least here in Argentina. Rasangi, can your question wait till next week?
I think so.
Okay, because
Can I
I
just
have a
quickly?
few, it's my last few days here in Argentina, and I may have to do something with my mom now.
Yes.
So I'm trying to save some time for my son. Duties as well.
Sounds good.
Thank you. But save that one for next weekend for sure.
I will. It's still going to be there. The question will
Yeah.
still be there, I
Okay.
think.
I trust. Okay. But we will go a few minutes to conclude as usual to one more churning room, breakout room, for you to share whatever you would like to share in terms of what I just shared regarding Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Sikhism, regarding what we're talking about. Ritualism and offering the bhog and offering ourselves, or whatever you want to share of something else that came as a highlight from today, feel free to bring your heart in whatever shape needs to manifest and See you back in a few minutes before concluding today's session. There you are. Welcome back. Bless souls, brothers and sisters. Hoping you had a nice sharing and gathering together, further turning, further cohesiveness and empathy and connection. There's no limit to how much we can realize our interconnectedness, so how much we are family. So thank you so much to each one of you for your time, presence today, bearing witness, attention, questions, explorations. It's my honor and great fortune trying to somehow honor each one of you. So thank you for that. Great blessing, great favor. Hoping we can reciprocate somehow. I'm looking forward to seeing you next Saturday, same time. For me, different time because I will be in Colombia. So we will be connecting from Shyam Ashram in Cali. So looking forward to that. Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bol.